Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on inflation when we come back. Are you concerned about your privacy? How much does your government know about you, and how much do you want your government to know about you? Well, government only knows as much about you as you tell them about yourself. Everything that your government knows about you, or government, industry, or business, is because you told them. That's right, you told them. You filled out a report. The Fourth Amendment protects you when your person, houses, papers, and effects, but it doesn't protect you from yourself. Now, can we have privacy in the computer age? Well, you bet we can. Information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. It's knowing how that information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private that actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. So always keep in mind that no one knows anything about you that you haven't revealed by your own hand or your own mouth. Now, if you'd like to learn more about privacy and privacy issues, a part of my business school, why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour program. It's entertaining, it's informative, it's educational. Best of all, it's free. Just call the law school and order yours. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the webpage, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Inflation. We're all familiar with inflation. We've lived with it all of our lives. I'm an old man now. I have never known a time without inflation. I did know a period when we had just weights and balances. We had silver coin until 1964. We had gold coin until 1933. I don't remember the gold coin, but I do remember the silver coin, and I remember President Johnson, in a speech, said that this was the most significant financial or monetary reform in the United States since the Coinage Act of 1792, and boy, he wasn't just whistling Dixie. In the 1970s, that is 1971, President Nixon cut our payments in gold in international trade. We now have a fiat currency. Every country in the world has a fiat currency. The Japanese do, the Russians, the Americans, the Canadians, everybody uses this fiat currency. Well, has there ever been a time in history when people used fiat currencies, and we can look back in history and see, well, what was the result of it? Was it prosperity? Was it wealth? Was it good times and parties? Or was there some different outcome? We'll take a look at the story of inflation over the past 200 years. We've had inflation. We had inflation in 1800. We had inflation in 1820, 1830, 1850, 1890. And as we look at 200 years of inflation, we find that the general rise in prices didn't begin until after 1933. The price of a house in 1930 was about the same as it was in 1850, which was about the same as it was in 1800. You know, adjusted for all other things, that is, economic output and the efficiency that we develop with the machine age and so on, productivity. You add those things in, and there's some real advantages. For instance, I'll give you a quick example. In 1943, my Uncle Carol was in the Army Air Force, stationed in Orlando, Florida, and we used to call him about once a week. And you'd place a call from Eureka, California. It took about 20 minutes to a half an hour to complete the call. I mean, you'd pick up the telephone, and you'd get the operator, and you'd give her the number you wanted in Orlando, and then you'd hang up, and she'd call back when she got the other party on the line, party you were trying to call. Well, a three-minute telephone call back in 1943 cost $3 and change. I forgot exactly, $3.40 or $3.70 and change. We'll call it $3.50 just to round it off. Seems to me it was $3.74. Kind of rattles around in my old brain, but it was $3.50. Now, today, when I get on the air, I can call my producer. In fact, I don't have to call the operator. I just dial direct, and it costs me about 5 cents a minute. I can talk on the air for an hour. It bounces off of a satellite now, and if you take a look at the cost of a long-distance call in 1920 compared with what it is today, I mean, it was about $20 back in 1920 to make a long-distance call coast to coast. Today, I can call my producer in Austin, Texas, or out in California, or up in Michigan, and it costs me 5 cents a minute, $3 to talk for a whole hour. Imagine that. So inflation certainly hasn't been a problem with telephone calls. In fact, technology and the constant effect of worker productivity over the years has now made telephone calls more reasonable than they've ever been. I don't think there's anybody in the world can talk for less than we do here. We complain a lot about the postal service. We complain a lot about a penny postcard, for instance. A penny postcard in 1950 cost 8 cents. In 1974, costs 22 cents today. But if you take a look at the amount of time that you had to work in 1950 to buy a penny postcard and the amount of time that you have to work today to buy a 22-cent postcard, in real terms, it's more expensive today than it was in 1950. In fact, when you went to buy an automobile back in 1950, it cost you around $1,200 to $1,500. Today, it cost you around $30,000. In real terms, automobiles are much more expensive today in the amount of hours that you have to work to buy one than they were back in 1950, but houses today are cheaper. In fact, it's about $1 per square foot cheaper today to buy a house than it was back in 1950. And the average house size has gone up from around 800 square feet back in 1950 to nearly 2,000 square feet today. So if you take a look at inflation on balance, some things are cheaper and some things are more expensive. As a general rule, the price level has increased 10 times since 1950. So what you were working for in 1950 that cost you $1 today will cost you $10 as a general rule. You know, add in the telephone costs or telephone calls and houses and automobiles and food and shoes and clothes and everything that we buy today cost 10 times more on average than they did back in 1950. Some things cost 20 or 30 times more. Some things are actually cheaper. Balanced out. Put this number on your paper here, boys and girls, 10 times. Now, let's take a look at the price of gasoline. Because of Hurricane Katrina, the price of gasoline has gone up to around $3 a gallon. In some places, it's a little over. As I speak to you today, the price of gas here is about $2.75 a gallon. I saw on the news the other night, $3.25. So, you know, depending upon where you live in the country and the accessibility of gasoline, it's around $3. Well, let me tell you this. When I was a kid back in the 1950s, gasoline in Eureka, California was 37 cents a gallon at the Standard Station at Wabash and Broadway. 37 cents a gallon. Through most of the 1950s. Now, we had gas wars back in those days, and the price of gas would go down to as low as 25 cents, and then it'd go up to 30 cents, and 32, and 34, and then it'd drop back to 25, or 28, or 29, or 30 cents. And around the country, the average price of gas back in 1950 was 27.3 cents per gallon. In some locations, a little higher, some locations a little less, but around $3 a gallon today is the equivalent of 30 cents back in 1950. So when you're paying $3 a gallon for gasoline, boys and girls, you're not working any more hours today to buy a gallon of gas at $3 than you were working back in 1950 to buy gas at 30 cents a gallon. So on balance, when we take a look at this thing called inflation, you know, we're not as bad off as we thought we were. Well, I'm going to show you that you're not as bad off today in the year 2005 as you thought you were, but that doesn't mean that it isn't going to get worse in the future. Fiat currencies and inflation have always destroyed the economies of the nations, the empires and civilization that engaged in that fiat currency or fiat currency creation. There's never been an exception, although we Americans can now claim the longest running fiat currency or paper money of any nation, city, state, or empire in the world. We started in 1913. We've had some bumps along the way, like the Great Depression of the 1930s. We've had recessions like the recession of 1921, 1948, 1954, 1958, 1971, 1979, 1991. I mean, there's been recessions and depressions. There's been some bumps in the road, but on balance, you know, we Americans can make that claim that we've had a fiat currency longer than anybody. Now, if you want to know what the general rise in prices has been since 1930, going back another 20 years from 1950, the general price increases from 1800 to 1930 were about the same. In other words, what cost you a dollar in 1800 would cost you a dollar in 1930. And that's because some years had negative inflation. If you take a look at the inflation chart, which you can get off the web, by the way, you go back to 1800, and there was inflation in 1800 and 1810 and 1820 and 30, but there was also deflationary periods. There were years when prices dropped by 15% in a year, and there were times when prices increased by 5 or 10% in a year. And that kind of reflected the wars and reflected the various economic conditions of the times. But on balance, from 1800 to 1930, 130-year period, the price index was relatively stable. But beginning about 1930, with the Great Depression, things took a serious turn for the worse. And we have had a steady 5% compounded annually price increase from 1930 until 2000. In fact, it's accelerated from 2000 to 2005 beyond 5%. Now, they tell us that inflation is running around 3%, and they tell us that 3% inflation is good. 3% inflation is okay. We can live with 3%. I want to tell you, boys and girls, that 3% inflation compounded annually for 25 years means that your money in 25 years will have depreciated by 50%. Now, if you take a look at the depreciation of your money from 1930 to today, 2005, it has depreciated by 97 times, or 97%. It now takes a dollar to buy what 3 cents would buy in 1930. A dollar today buys what 3 cents would buy then. Or, you know, put another way, if you had a $20 bill, and you put that $20 bill in the top drawer of your dresser in 1930, and you had a $20 gold piece, and you put that $20 gold piece in your dresser, second drawer down, and you kept it from 1930 to 2000, and you took the $20 bill and the $20 gold piece out, and you went down to John's suit shop, and let's see what you can get with it. First of all, John won't take the $20 gold piece, so you take that over to Charlie, and you trade that in, and Charlie today will give you about 460 Federal Reserve note dollars for that $20 gold piece, in round numbers. With that $450, we just rounded off to $450, you go over to John's suit shop, and you can buy a Hickey Freeman suit, a pair of wingtip shoes. You can buy a shirt and a tie and a pair of suspenders, socks. In other words, you can buy an entire suit and shoes and everything that goes with it for that $450 easy today. You probably have change left over. Now take the $20 bill, which in 1930, both of them bought the same amount of goods and services, and hand John the $20 bill. And then tell him that you want to trade that in. And I think he might give you one silk tie for a $20 bill. Now, can you see what's happened to your money? So if you saved paper money from 1930 until 2005, you lost 97% of your purchasing power. On the other hand, if you spent every dollar that you got your hands on between 1930 and today, you lived pretty darn well. Your telephone calls today cost you less. Computers cost you less than they did 20 years ago. There are a lot of things that inflation hasn't touched. There's a lot of things that inflation has touched, but gasoline's not one of them, at least not yet. Now, as we progress along, I think you're going to find that gasoline, like it is in Europe, it sells for $6 a gallon in Europe. Did you know that? $6 a gallon. In England, it's over $6 a gallon. I don't know what it is for, you know, for every country, but in Italy, in 1974, gasoline hit $3 a gallon back in 1974 when we were paying 60 cents. Do you remember that? Price of gas went from 30 cents to 60 cents by 1974, and we thought, the end of the world has come. Price of gasoline has doubled. Well, in Italy, they were paying $3, and that's why they drive small cars in Japan, you know, economy cars in England. That's why Mr. Bean drives that little tiny car. That's because gasoline is so expensive over there, and we Americans have been spared from that. We've been buying this cheap gas at $1.50 and $2 a gallon when everybody else was paying $6. They're paying three times that in the rest of the world. Isn't that just special? Now, the inflation is about to come down on us. Not just in America, but worldwide, and an economic collapse is about to descend upon us, an economic black hole, a dark age, like the period between about 1000 and 1500. We call that the Middle Ages. It actually goes back to about 500 or 600 after the fall of the Roman Empire until about the 15th century when we started to get a little more enlightened in the world. About 1,000 years there, but 500 of it was really pretty poor. About half of that 1,000-year period was really pretty poor. And people lived pretty dirt scrabble poor, and we had great plagues, like the bubonic plague came through Europe in the 14th century and wiped out about 100 million people. That's what economic collapse spells. It spells poverty, and then poverty spells hunger, and hunger spells weakened immune systems, and weakened immune systems spell out disease, and disease kills people in biblical terms, by the tens and then hundreds of millions of people. 6 billion people in the world, and an economic catastrophe at this juncture of time is going to spell the deaths of about 90% of the world's population. I didn't just pull that number out of thin air. I pulled it out of Isaiah chapter 6, verse 13. So if you want to check me out on that, just go ahead. And then Revelation chapter 6 tells a little bit more of the story over there, where it says 1/4 of mankind. Now you take 1/4 of 6 billion people, boys and girls, and that's 1.5 billion people. Check me out on that. It's called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, Revelation chapter 6. As you're reading down through the famines and disease and the white horse and the black horse and the red horse and the green horse and the charcoal horse and so on, as you're going through these horses, you find one of them over there talking about disease, famine and disease. 1/4, the fourth part of men were killed. Hey, you think that Hurricane Katrina was something. You wait until we get into the really tough times. We haven't gotten there yet. We're getting slapped around a little bit, bounced off the wall a couple of times. But we haven't got to the real bad parts yet. Well, let me tell you a story from the Figge Report. A guy by the name of Harry Figge, he was tapped on the shoulder by a guy named Peter Grace. And Figge gave a couple of reports. In fact, he gave three reports. I'll tell you where he gave them. The first one was at Los Angeles, California, June 27th, 1988. The City Club of Cleveland, Ohio, March 31st, 1989. And the League of Women Voters in Cleveland, Ohio, July 26th, 1990. Now, that Los Angeles meeting was called the Town Hall of Los Angeles, June 27th, 1988. Gave this speech three times. Little booklet here, put out by Figge International at 4420 Sherwin Road, Willoughby, Ohio. Zip code's 44094. A pretty old book. It's just a little pamphlet. I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12. Yeah, it's 13 pages here. 13 pages. And it's a story on the national debt. The national debt from 1787 until the year 2000, and then where the national debt goes from the year 2000 on through about 2005. We're up to $8 trillion now. We're on our way to $13 trillion here in the next 4 or 5 years. How are we going to pay that debt back? The answer is we're not going to pay it back. We're not going to. So don't worry about it. So if you've been concerned about the national debt and how we're going to saddle our children with this horrendous debt and they're going to have to pay it back, no, you can forget about that. Your children are not going to be paying this debt back in the year 20, 30, 50, 90 or something like that. Long before then, the economy is going to collapse into a heap. And you and I, the profligate spenders over the last 50 years, are going to get an opportunity to see what the net results are after we spend ourselves into prosperity. And that's what we've been doing since 1930. Franklin D. Roosevelt said with his New Deal program, what we need here is a government that cares about the people. And we need a government that's going to spend on projects that's going to help people. And he did that. And he introduced to us the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. See, up until 1930, we weren't really whole hog players in the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. But after 1933, we became whole hog players, and we've been that way over the past 70 or 75 years. Now, in the Figge report, this is a warning, and this is one of those Chicken Little kind of stories, you know, where the sky is falling, and if you don't take action, we've had an opportunity to watch this. So he delivered this last speech, July 26, 1990. So we've had 15 years now to watch and to see whether or not what this little book says is true or false. So let's take a look at the book and let's see whether or not Harry Figge hit the nail on the head. He says in the heading here, tackle the debt before it's too late. Harry E. Figge Jr. He said, I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you today on the subject of the national debt. And I want to stress first and foremost that I'm a businessman. And I've never been and never intend to be involved in politics. However, if you wonder why I'm up here, I really love this country. And because as I tell people, where else but in the United States could a person from very humble means, whose father died when he was 16, follow his life's plan and build two companies? And I'm here today because I fully believe that this great country of ours is headed into serious trouble because the government's dangerous inability to reduce its debt or control ongoing budget deficits. I became involved in this issue quite by accident in 1982 when Peter Grace made me a co-chairman of the President's Private Sector Survey on Cost Control called the Grace Commission. And as a result of that, I became privy to some information that I wished I'd never heard about, information that showed me how threatening our government spending policies are. And this past Tuesday, I met with several congressmen on the subject, including Congressman Dennis Eckert from Cleveland and Congressman Dick Armey from Texas. And I showed six different congressmen the debt and deficit projections for the next few years, and every one of them said, gee, I didn't know that it was that bad. I didn't realize where we were headed. They had no idea that the ball game is going to be over around 1995. Dick was an economics professor and is probably the most knowledgeable man in Congress on economics. And after I showed him the projections, Dick said, Harry, you just ruined my day. And I said, it's about time somebody ruined your day. Peter ruined mine back in 1982, and I haven't had a good day since. Now, surveys show how the national debt and the national deficit are uppermost in the minds of the American people. Congress recognizes this, and they say that it was the savings and loan crisis that finally brought it home to the American people. But I say that it was perfectly understandable all along because the Americans have been struggling personally with debts and deficits and budgets all of their lives, and they know what happens to them if they don't live within their personal income. So naturally, they begin to worry when they see a profitable country that is not living within its income and hasn't lived within its income since 1952. Now, I want to put this massive problem into the context of the person in the street and show you why the government is headed into real trouble. Let's say that you have a net take-home pay of $1,000, and you take $100 out of that $1,000, and you put it into some kind of a pension plan, like a Kroger, an IRA, or a 401k. Now, the other $900 is what it takes to make ends meet. Now, let's suppose that somebody gives you free credit cards. They give you American Express, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, whatever you want. But you realize that you can't use these credit cards. You can't use them because you can't service the debt on these credit cards. You're just barely able to make ends meet with the $900 that you're taking home every week. Well, then all of a sudden, you meet a very tall man with a long white beard, a big stovepipe hat, red and white striped pants, and a blue coat and stars all over it, and he says, my name is Sam, Uncle Sam, and I'm a financial advisor, and I want you to follow my financial advice. I want you to use your credit cards. And when they bill you, just send them a 30-year IOU at 8% interest. And you say, yeah, but I have to pay the interest, even if they accept my IOUs. Well, Sam says, do you remember that $100 that you were putting into your pension plan? Well, take that $100 and use that to pay the interest. And then put an IOU in your pension plan. 20 years from now, you'll have 20 years of IOUs. But what do you care? So you remind Uncle Sam that there's a difference between you and me. You've got a printing press in your basement, which gives you unlimited credit. But I'm going to go to jail if I do that. Now, that's why Americans are concerned. Because Americans know that we can't keep going on like this forever. So before I go on any further, let me explain the difference between deficit and debt for those of you that might not be familiar with these terms. The deficit is the shortfall that we have in any one calendar year. If you take $100 billion and then you spend $110 billion, you get a deficit of $10 billion. So at the end of that year, you've got to do something with that $10 billion that you owe. So you move it over to your long-term shortfall, and that becomes your debt. Well, in 1982, the annual deficit was $128 billion. It was up from $4 billion in 1974. From $4 billion in 74 to $128 billion in 82. So in less than 10 years, 8 years, the debt went from $4 to $128 billion. That is the annual deficit. Now, the debt in 82 was $1 trillion, up from $484 billion in 1974. But it had taken us 200 years from the start of our republic until 1974 to create that debt of $484 billion. We had gone through World War I and World War II, the Korean and Vietnam Wars, and we still had a very manageable situation in 1974. Since 1982, when the debt first hit $1 trillion, it has now tripled to $3 trillion. So in 8 years, it's gone from $1 trillion to $3 trillion. Now, when Peter Grace called me and a number of other businessmen down to Washington back in 1982, we were commissioned by President Reagan to find some savings in government. And I can tell you that it was like shooting fish in a rain barrel. We identified and contributed $77 million of corporate money and about 500 employees to this project. We found more than $425 billion in savings in 9 months. 500 employees identified $425 billion in savings in just 9 months. We could easily have identified over $1 trillion, but Reagan wasn't interested in going any further. Of the $424 billion that we identified, Congress instituted $152 billion in savings by 1986. Spread out annually, that averages $38 billion in savings a year. And at the same time, President Reagan pushed through a $50 billion tax increase. Now, you take the $50 billion of new revenue and the $38 billion of savings, that's $88 billion a year. That should have gone to reduce the deficit, which at that time was $128 billion. So we should have dropped the annual deficit to $40 billion. Instead of that, the government says we ran a $152 billion deficit last year. Now, the problem is, in the last 10 years, government revenue has risen by 8% every year compounded, but expenditures have gone up 11% every year compounded. Now, that doesn't sound like too much, but let me put it in perspective for you. Right now, Congress has 116% more money to spend than they had 10 years ago, but they have spent 186% more, and they will spend more money over the next 10 years than they have over the past 10 years. And every time you give them $1, they go out and spend $1.58. Now, I'll tell you what I learned in Washington. They not only don't understand this problem, they don't even care about it. They not only don't understand it, boys and girls, they don't even care. Now, this is back in 1990. Remember that? He's out on the road stumping now, telling the American people, Peter Grace Commission. And let me tell you what's going on. What's changed over the last 15 years from 1990 to 2005? We'll stand by and we'll tell more of that story when we come back. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call The Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, georgegordon.org, the webpage, or call direct, area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about inflation this week, and we're covering the Figge Report. The Figge Report comes from the Grace Commission, which was commissioned by President Reagan in 1982 to find cost-effective savings in government spending to balance the budget. Here's Mr. Figge's report. He goes on to say, "The thing that really brought me up short and has ruined my last 8 years were the projections that Peter got from his economist, and these numbers that I'm going to give you I've had verified in the last 6 months by the Citizens Against Government Waste, so they're very current. As of 1990. We were at $1 trillion in debt in 1982. That debt is going to be $13 trillion in the year 2000. Well, now they missed that projection because it's only $8 trillion. See, it's only $8 trillion by the year 2000. And we were at an annual deficit of $128 billion, and the deficit is going to go to $2 trillion by the year 2000. Well, it's not $2 trillion, it's only $500 billion, only a half a trillion dollars a year. So we've actually made some progress, haven't we, boys and girls? Now, let me graph the debt on my thumb and forefinger. I've got my thumb horizontal and my finger vertical. You've got 1776 way out here at the tip of my thumb. The debt line runs along my thumb absolutely flat until 1976, and then it gets up into the web of my thumb in about 1980 and starts to come up about 1995. We're at the first knuckle of my finger. Now, you turn asymptotic. You start going straight up, and by the year 2000, you're straight up to the top. Now, what does that mean? It means that when we hit the $500 billion deficit here in 1995, now remember, we didn't hit the $500 billion deficit until George Bush took office around 2000. So now we're hitting $500 billion a year deficits. Well, you know, $300, $400, $500. And that's what they admit to. Now, they don't tell you about that $100 billion they're spending out of Social Security every year. That's off budget. So he says it's going up here in 1995 to $2 trillion in 2000. We've lost our ability to control our economy by taxation, and we run the risk of something that I'm going to talk about called hyperinflation. All right, boys and girls, write that down on your paper. Hyperinflation, hyperinflation, because that's the next step in the scenario. Now, notice that the Grace Commission here missed this by about 5, 6, 7 years. So they're about 7 years behind. During the Clinton years, we actually had some budget surpluses. Well, they called them budget surpluses. And so we actually turned the corner here, and then something drastic happened. The economy, the stock market bubble popped in March of 2000, and so we needed a new program. We needed to re-liquefy, re-inflate the economy. So from the Bush years in 2001 until here we are near 2005, President Bush has not vetoed a single spending bill. They've started two wars, one in Afghanistan and one in Iraq. And thank God for Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita. Yeah, I say thank God. See, you have to get this money out into circulation somehow, and the traditional way of doing that is by way of war. You get yourself involved in a war so that you can increase spending to get this money out into circulation. Well, Hurricane Katrina is going to add about $500 billion to the spending. And this $500 billion of new spending is going to stimulate the economy. I mean, you know, it's bad news for you people down on the Gulf Coast, and we feel real sorry for you, but, you know, we needed this to stimulate our economy. We feel real bad about the people being killed over in Iraq, and that's a tragedy for all you people. But think about the greater public good that's being served by putting $5 billion plus into the economy every month by that war over in Iraq. And there's a little side effect that comes from that. It also guarantees our future oil imports coming from the Middle East. They have about 25% of the world's proven oil reserves, and we're going to make a neat little tidy deal, we along with the British. See, the British took over that Iraqi oil concession back around 1908, and they had it until about the 1960s or so, and then they kind of lost it. That was called British Petroleum, and so now we're going back over there and take it away again. All right, so that's where we're at here in the year 2005, but there's more to the story. He said, back in 82, I said, well, we've got some time, and nobody's going to be this stupid. We're going to get people to understand this thing, and I'm very sorry to tell you that as I stand here in 1990, we're somewhere between 1990 and 1993 in our budget deficit projections, a little ahead of target. I was with Senator Robert Dole the other day. He'd just come from the White House budget negotiations, and he said, we didn't make any progress again today, but we will, he said. Now, you've all heard about the Graham-Redmond bill. It used to be Graham-Redmond and Hollings, but Senator Hollings said he wanted a divorce from the bill because it was such a travesty. Graham Redman originally said we would have a zero deficit in 1991, but we revised that to $60 to $65 billion a couple of years later. The reason Congress runs around like chickens with their heads off right now is technically, unless they get a budget agreement, they've got to cut $100 billion out of the budget this year because they're at least $168 billion short. The thing I want to tell you is that that $168 billion you hear about is a travesty. It's a lie. It's been foisted on the American people, but it is a lie. Now, remember all those IOUs that you were peeling out of your pension funds and your credit card fees? Well, government doesn't count those as part of the cash deficit. You see, we have for 6 years run an annual deficit in the U.S. government of over $250 billion. And this year, we're running between $360 and $435 billion deficit. So let me explain that to you. Start with the Graham Redman bill. That's $168 billion. Now, remember the credit card example when you took $100 away from your Kroger or your IRA and then you sent them an IOU instead? Well, the government is doing that to 9 trust funds, including Social Security, military pensions, railway pensions, and postal pensions. You see, the federal government is taking $120 billion in trust fund surpluses and replacing those cash funds with those IOUs. Instead of funding them with cash, they're funding them with federal deficit. And they don't count those IOUs or the interest on them. And when those IOUs start coming due, the government is going to owe trillions of dollars to Social Security, which will be supporting more retirees with fewer workers. So that's the first thing that's been foisted off on the people of America. Then there's the savings and loan crisis. That's another. Moshbacher, our country's head economist, made very sure when Bush stuck his neck out on the savings and loan crisis that those costs were taken off the deficit. Current estimates are that the savings and loans will cost us about $500 billion overall and about $100 billion next year. There's another $100 billion that's not being counted. So the deficit's gone from $168 billion to $388 billion, and I haven't talked to you about the student loan problem. And I haven't talked to you about the $300 to $500 billion toxic waste cleanup problem that's going to come from our military bases. And I haven't told you about the crack babies or AIDS or any of the new programs that Congress is talking about. So right now, we're running a true deficit of $300 to $500 billion a year, and this is 1990. And my estimate is that at $500 billion, we lose our capability to control our economy by taxation. Now, don't ever think for a minute that Congress doesn't want inflation, because Congress knows that the only way that they can pay off the debt is with inflated dollars. And if that isn't bad enough, the financial structure of the United States is now very tenuous. And I'll give you a few examples. We definitely have a recession on the horizon, and we're just beginning to see it. We're seeing it in the future. We're seeing it in houses. We're seeing it in furniture, all through construction and in aerospace. Now, let's talk about our commercial banks. Since 1983, 713 commercial banks have failed. Now, that's only 5% of the commercial banks in the United States. But when you fail 5% of your banks in your good years, can you imagine what bad times are going to do? Now, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation Chairman Bill Seidman came out the other day, and he said, if we get a severe recession, the safety net that we have under the commercial banks will never hold. There isn't enough money in FDIC. Now, most people don't realize this, but 13 insurance companies failed in 1988. Now, I'm talking about property and casualty, not health insurance companies. Property and casualty companies. 39 failed in 1989. So we've had 52 insurance companies fail over the past 2 years. Now, the other thing you don't hear about is that the federal government is underwriting $5.8 trillion of debt from things that aren't truly government, such as deposit insurance, loan guarantees, pension programs, government-sponsored enterprises, direct loan programs, and it goes on and on. So if we get a severe downturn, and after 50-some years of recovery, it's got to be sitting out there somewhere. We're going to be, to steal the words of a man whose lips we all watched carefully, in deep doo-doo. And I find it frightening that this rapid rate of deterioration. And it's the old story that the light at the end of the tunnel may be an oncoming train. And when we can go 200 years and create less than $500 trillion in debt, and then in the next 16 years go to $3 trillion in debt, we're really seeing things get bad very rapidly. So the question is, what's going to happen? Now, one of the people that I respect most in government is Chuck Bowser. He's the former Arthur Anderson partner who's Comptroller General of the United States. Chuck was sent to New York City about 10 years ago to straighten it out financially. And he said that he and the governor, Governor Kerry, sat at a table day after day. And Kerry made some real tough decisions until they got New York into the kind of shape that they could sell its bonds again. So I took my hyperinflation scenario to Chuck and I said, Chuck, tell me if I'm wrong. And he said, you're wrong. I said, great, what's going to happen? He said, we're going to have a fiscal panic. We're going to get to the point where the central banks of the world, like Japan and Germany, can see that we're not going to be able to service our debt, and they're going to quit buying our bonds. And I said, great, now we're going to have a fiscal panic. We're not going to go into hyperinflation. Can you imagine a businessman standing around cheering for a financial panic? But nothing happened. And after 4 weeks, I started to wonder what those bonds were doing. Well, I think you know that at one point, Japan was buying 35% of our debt. But in about the last 6 to 8 weeks, the Japanese market broke, and I found that the Japanese have scaled back, but the Saudis came in and replaced them 100%. Now we're back to my scenario, which incidentally scares the hell out of me. What our charts show is that in 1995, we're going to be able to control our deficit and our other debt by taxation. But after 1995, we're not going to be able to control the debt by taxation any longer, and we're going to move to what's called hyperinflation. Right, now let me add something here. That hasn't happened between the year 1995 and 2005 over the past 10 years. We haven't gotten to hyperinflation yet. But it's just around the corner now, boys and girls. In fact, your Federal Reserve is putting money out just as fast as they can print it, money and credit, every week. It's several billion dollars a week. And that's to keep this inflated bubble, this economic bubble, going a little while longer. And, of course, the longer it goes, the more dramatic it's going to be when it pops. And that's just the bottom line. Now, we've all known this. I mean, I don't think I'm telling any of you people out there anything that you haven't known, haven't expected, and probably expected it long before now. But bend over, boys and girls, it's just about time to kiss her goodbye. Now, this is the Figge Report, remember, back in 1990. And what you're reading today in the Wall Street Journal and USA Today, while it's 10 years behind the projections that were projected from 1982 to 1995, they missed it by 10 years. Now, you can thank God for Hurricane Katrina, because it's going to give us an excuse to spend $500 billion, maybe up to $1 trillion, which is going to keep this bubble going for another year, maybe through the year 2006, maybe even the year 2007. We may have a couple of more years to prepare for this coming economic collapse. That's the good news. You got a couple of more years. Now, what you're going to do with those 2 more years is up to you, isn't it? Now, he goes on to say here, I think you know that at one point Japan was buying 35% of our debt. They stopped, and the Saudis came in, and then they started buying 100% of it. Well, today, in the year 2005, boys and girls, we are being financed at the rate of $2 billion a day, $2 billion a day by foreign central bank. And now that they've started cutting back, we've started monetizing the debt. That is, our Federal Reserve is just issuing new money through Caribbean banks. And it's those Caribbean banks that are buying our bonds. So the Federal Reserve offers the bonds in Washington. The Caribbean banks, which is the Federal Reserve, is buying their own bonds, monetizing the debt to keep the bubble from popping. By what I mean severe, runaway inflation that leads to devaluation of the currency. Now, Brazil and Argentina, they've lopped 6 zeros off of their money in the past few years. That meant that if you had $1 million at the first lop, you had $1,000. The second lop, you had $1. I'll talk about that a little later. During World War II, when I was fighting house to house in Germany, I found an old cigar box on the floor where a bunch of money had been spilled up. So I picked it up and I looked at it, and it was Weimar Republic money from 1923. Totally worthless. So I picked up about 8 or 10 of those bills, and I liberated them, and I brought them home. They hang in my office today. One especially frightens me because it's a 100 million mark note. 100 million mark note. In 1923, they were taking bushel baskets of those down to the store to try to buy potatoes and bread. And so that is a great reminder to me. To find out about hyperinflation, we looked at all the countries in the world. The German and the French experience with hyperinflation was too long ago. Israel is in microcosm. Russia is unknown. Yugoslavia was just getting started. They were up 2,000%. When we looked at South America, we said, there's where it's at. We picked Argentina, Brazil, and Bolivia as the best examples. Now listen to this, boys and girls. Get your pencil out. Now, the problem I run into when I talk to people about this is they say, well, oh, you studied the banana republics. And I have two parts to my answer. The first is, well, welcome to the United States Banana Republic. And the second answer, and most people don't know this, is that in 1938, the fifth largest economy in the world was the country of Argentina. That's right, boys and girls, Argentina, 1938, the fifth largest economy. It was very sophisticated, very well run, very knowledgeable. It had excellent agriculture, excellent manufacturing, and good resources. They're now the world's 78th largest market. So if you think it can't happen in the United States, it can. It happened in Argentina. And for our study, we were very fortunate because we were able to meet with 80 top businessmen in those three countries, Bolivia, Brazil, and Argentina. And they weren't just businessmen. They were government officials, bankers, financial executives. Dr. Jerry Swanson, an economist from the University of Arizona, led our team and took one of our group of controllers and directors of purchasing. They took 4 trips over a 2-year period. The thing that happened is that all 80 of these businessmen said to us, what's wrong with you in the United States? You're on exactly the same course that we were on, but about 20 or 30 years behind us. And they said, everything that we did wrong, you are now doing wrong. For example, you have large deficits. You have a deterioration in your balance of payments. You have eroded the confidence in your currency. You have a tendency to blame outsiders and call for protectionism. And finally, the exchange value of your currency is falling. Twice since the mid-70s, we've devalued our currency, and there's pressure now to devalue again. And they said all 5 factors are in place, and the United States is following the path to hyperinflation. We can't understand why you don't see it coming. When Jerry came back from his last trip, I said, Jerry, give me a synopsis. And he said, well, for years in my economics courses at the University of Arizona, I've been teaching that deficits cause inflation. Then he said, they do. I just saw it in three countries. I said, okay, tell me about hyperinflation. How much time do you have before hyperinflation sets in? You ready for this, boys and girls? Sharpen your pencil now on both ends. How much time do you have before hyperinflation sets in? And he said, in Brazil, it set in 3 days. You got that, boys and girls? 3 days, that's 72 hours. Now, the terrible thing about hyperinflation is once it gets started, you can't stop it. You see them trying to stop it now in Argentina. You see them trying now how to stop it in Brazil. Brazil's a good example. They put in wage and price controls. They seized 80% of the capital of the people. They did all the right things, but 54% of the people worked for the government, and they turned around and gave them pay increases to keep peace. They're reinflating their economy right now. And during the time that we were studying this, Argentina's inflation hit 5,000%. Brazil's got to 5,000%, and Bolivia's got to 25,000% with bursts of up to 50,000% inflation. All right, boys and girls, now that's what we're getting ready for here in the United States. I'll just bring it to your attention through the Figge report that although Figge and the Grace Commission were a little bit ahead of their time, President Bush is running $500 billion a year plus deficits. The real deficits, boys and girls, are closer to $1 trillion a year. When you take all the money that they're taking out of Social Security and all of these trust and pension funds, hey, boys and girls, it's time to wake up to reality. Hyperinflation is right on the horizon. It ain't here yet. But it's on the horizon. If you've got dollar-denominated assets, it's time to unload them, don't you think? Hey, we're just about out of time. I got to cut it off right here. We'll be back again next time with more on inflation and what we can expect in the future next time. Hey, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, around the world over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course, until then. Thanks for listening, and good night, friends.